I just want to remind everybody in class next time on Friday, I'm going to distribute to you the exact terms for the essay part of the final exam. And then for those of you who are just listening to this on the Bruincast, I'll put that on the course website by Monday. So that gives people a certain incentive to attend class on Friday. Today, I'm going to be talking about the events of late 1962 and 1963, which is it's the culmination of the entire story that we've been dealing with in this second half of the course. Because it's in this period that the rudiments of a stable international system are finally put into place. Right. Why is that important for us? It's important because it bears on this fundamental question that we have about how the Cold War is to be understood and how the coming into being of a relatively stable international system during the Cold War period, the Cold War political system, which provided the basis for a reasonable relationship between East and West, which meant that the risk of a nuclear holocaust, a Third World War, you know, basically receded into the background, never entirely negligible, but very, very small. See, those issues about how the Cold War is to be understood, how the coming of a stable peace during the Cold War period is to be understood, have a larger theoretical importance. There aren't that many cases that we look at in the recent history of great power politics, say over the last 200 years, to get insight into this question of what makes for war, you know, among the great powers, the system as a whole. And conversely, what makes for a stable international order? Those are the by far the most important questions that international relations theorists are concerned with. They're the questions that define the field. And you get insight into those issues by just looking at this handful of cases. You know, in the 20th century, you have the First World War, the Second World War in Europe, the Second World War in Asia. And then the Cold War. Basically, there are only those four great cases. So in this part of the class, we're concerned with the Cold War. And how do we go about framing the problem? By approaching it as a story of three false dawns followed by one true dawn. We looked at the fundamental political problem, the question of Germany. We looked at how the two sides were trying to deal with that. How there are various points where you might have thought that the two sides would reach at least a tacit understanding, some sort of accommodation, and an understanding that could have provided the basis for a stable system, something both sides could live with. Maybe not ideal, but they could live with it, vastly preferable to war. We looked at the Potsdam system in 1945 and 1949, the kind of formal division of Europe into blocks, and then the 1954, the system established by the Paris Accords and so on. Those three cases were of interest because it seemed like those arrangements were arrangements that everyone could live with. And in all three of those cases, we noted that, no, they didn't provide the basis for a stable system. After 1945, you had the Cold War breaking out in 1946. And after 1949, you had the Korean War breaking out in 1950. After the Paris Accords were signed, 4 years later, you have a new and very serious round of crises beginning with the Khrushchev's ultimatum on Berlin in November 58. Right?
And so we focused in on those issues. What went wrong? What had gone wrong? What was the heart of the problem? Was it ideological? Was
the Soviets just so impossible? You couldn't expect them to really accept true peaceful coexistence of the West. The answer there was no. The problem was a lot more subtle, more complex than that. In the case of the 1954 arrangements, it had to do with this American policy, the Eisenhower policy, the policy of building up Europe, enabling the European allies to provide for their own defense. And that meant arming them with nuclear weapons, and that meant in particular arming the Germans with nuclear weapons. There were people even in the Eisenhower administration who objected to this kind of thing. You know, said, "Oh, you can't allow the Germans to touch these things. You know, that's going to create all kinds of problems. Look what happened. In the past, World War I, World War II." Eisenhower didn't buy any of that stuff. You know, he says, "Of course, Germany had been a problem in the past, but that had been because Russia had been weak. Now that Russia is strong, I'll take a strong Germany." You know, that's straight power politics. That's straight realism, right? It's like you're thinking solely in terms of power realities. You're not concerned with national character or ideology or anything like that. So Eisenhower moved ahead, not overtly, because a lot of this stuff was of dubious legality, the nuclear sharing policy. But it's quite clear what he had in mind, and that they were actually moving ahead under Eisenhower to arming the Europeans with American nuclear weapons. By the end of the Eisenhower period, the Europeans, and including the Germans, had control of hundreds of American nuclear weapons. Effective control, not legal control. And that was a big part of the problem there. Yeah. Eisenhower didn't view America as destined to be a European power, to have a permanent military presence in Europe. We're not cut out for that role, Eisenhower's view. You know, the Europeans, they're strong enough to do it on their own. We should help them. They should kind of come together and carry the burden of their own defense. Our neck shouldn't have to be on the chopping block. Right? This is the Eisenhower a philosophy. It's not absurd, but you look at the consequences that it had. Right. Yeah. A nuclear-armed Germany, necessarily a concern for the Russians. This is the number one security concern. Right. They're bound to react and to, in fact, use the most obvious source of leverage that they have, namely the fact that West Berlin, a Western enclave in the middle of communist East Germany, it's like very easy for the Soviets to apply pressure on the West by interfering with access to Berlin, by threatening the status of Berlin. You know, then what are we going to do? World War III? You know, question mark. That's the Eisenhower policy. You can see why it causes problems. 1961, change of administration. Totally different philosophy. Transformation of U.S. policy, U.S. European policy, not so much on the military side. There's a lot of rhetoric to the effect that the old Eisenhower policy of massive retaliation has been abandoned, and we've moved now toward flexible response, and especially in the nuclear area, we're now not going to just throw off all the nuclear weapons in one big massive blow, but we will have a protracted war. We'll fight it in a discriminate way. We'll avoid, hitting cities. We'll focus narrowly on the other side's strategic forces, right? That strategy was rhetoric. It was not taken seriously by the top political leadership. I remember after Kennedy had secretly tape recorded his most important meetings for the latter half of his presidency, and there's this really interesting meeting between Kennedy and his top advisors, including the Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. And McNamara says, "Oh, we're going to change our nuclear strategy."
and this whole thing of the controlled and discriminate general nuclear war. Now we're going to replace it with, what we want is a world where both sides have secure second strike capabilities, where no one has any incentive to go first. And Kennedy, McNamara, and Kennedy's national security advisor, George Money, are talking about this like it's this big joke, you know, about these nuclear strategies. We keep concocting these things that they don't really have any effect on the war plans and what we're actually planning to do at the operational level, but they exist for political purposes, and especially the purpose of convincing the Europeans to accept the concentration of control over nuclear operations in the event of war in American hands. The Americans were, they wanted to kind of concentrate power in their own hands within the Western alliance. This is very different from the Eisenhower strategy. In Eisenhower, America is kind of a mediator between the Europeans. The Germans want to go in one direction, the British in another, the French kind of in between. You want to kind of get these allies to kind of agree on a common policy, not bludgeon them into it, but just kind of encourage them to kind of come together. Right? That's the Eisenhower view. I mean, Kennedy, very different. Right? Kennedy is, we can't allow the Germans to have nuclear weapons. Absolutely fundamental. From that, it follows that the United States has to remain present in Central Europe. American troops have to remain on German territory on an indefinite basis, right? Because someone has to provide for the security of West Germany. We're not going to allow the Soviets to just kind of come in and take over all of Germany, all of continental Europe. Obviously not. We can't do that. We don't. So there has to be a counterweight to Soviet power on the continent. If the Germans aren't going to provide it, only the Americans can. So we're stuck there. It's not because we want to be an imperial power. It's because there's no purely European solution to the European security problem. The Americans have to provide it. We're stuck there. But if we're stuck there and we have to pay the price of being the protector of Western Europe, then we should get something in exchange. We have the right, basically, to call the shots for the Western alliance as a whole. Not only that, but if you're basically telling the Germans you can't go nuclear, how then can you say, oh, it's okay for the British, okay for the French to have their nuclear forces, we'll help them with that, because that just rubs the Germans' nose in the fact that they're being discriminated against. And what kind of alliance can you have with a country that's the object of such distrust and such discrimination? So you got to blur things a bit. You say, oh, yeah, well, we oppose all these national nuclear forces. You know, it's inconsistent with our basic philosophy of how a nuclear war would be run by the West. You know, you can't have all these different countries going off on their own with their own independent nuclear strategies. It would just mess things up. So everything has to be concentrated in American hands. And we have this general aversion to nuclear proliferation, meaning that no new countries should develop nuclear forces. And all these things, the purpose is to avoid giving the Germans the sense that they're being discriminated against. You know, our policy is very general. It applies not just to Germany, but it applies to everyone. So we want to get the British out of their nuclear business. We oppose the French nuclear capability and so on, right? This creates real problems in the alliance. But so you have this new policy under Kennedy. Right? Why is it important in terms of the larger issue that we're concerned with? It's important because it opens up the possibility of a deal, of a political understanding with the Soviets. Right? This whole arrangement that Kennedy has in mind, and he lays it out to Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, when they meet in Vienna in June of 1961. He's like, we're both great powers, right? We both have to proceed on a basis of respect for each other's interests as great powers. You know, again, very kind of realist sort of talk. Okay? We understand your concerns about Germany, and in fact, we share them. So we'll basically make sure that Germany doesn't have nuclear weapons. You know, not so much a gift, but this is something the Soviets obviously really want. In exchange for that, we want certain things in exchange. We want the Soviets also to respect the status quo, including the status quo around Berlin, including the status quo of a West Berlin under the military protection of the Western powers, right? They should respect the status quo in Berlin, and we will respect also the status quo of a non-nuclear West Germany. We will also respect the reality of Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence, and especially the reality of the East German state. Right? Let's everyone accept the status quo. Right? That's the Kennedy approach. See? Now you might have said, what should the Soviet reaction have been? You know, this is great. This is everything that we could hope for. Let's sign on the dotted line. Let's seal the deal. But they don't do that. They don't. And the world has to go through this whole round of crises in 61-62 before an arrangement of that sort comes into being, subject of the lecture today. Okay? Why don't they do it? After the fact, after the end of the Cold War, some of Khrushchev's advisors felt like a major opportunity had been missed. There's this, one of his key foreign policy advisors was a man named Troyanovsky, who wrote an article talking about this stuff. And he said, it was a big mistake. We should have done it. Why didn't they do it? Well, Khrushchev is not what you would call a sophisticated statesman. Very crude. He was a semi-illiterate, you realize. He could scarcely even write. Not subtle at all. He believed in the power of bluff and bluster. And from Khrushchev's point of view, this shift in American policy from Eisenhower to Kennedy, the fact that American policy had moved away from what it had been, and that the Americans were now willing to make all these, what the Soviets viewed as concessions, the shift in policy we viewed as Americans' concessions. This was a result of America's fear of war. This was a result of the fact that the Soviets had built up to a certain extent their strategic forces. The Americans were scared of war. You know, and the Soviets are basically shaking the tree with all their threats about Berlin. And look at this fruit that had fallen out. Now the Americans are willing to give us this, to give us that, accept East Germany, guarantee West Germany's not that nuclear status. These are big things. If we have gotten so much by taking that sort of line in the past, let's continue. No need for, to kind of reach a settlement with the West. We'll continue to shake the tree and see what else falls out. You know, big mistake on Khrushchev's part in the long run. Paid for it with his career. But that was the kind of calculation, I'm sure, that was made, because the deal was on the table, and the Soviets said, no thanks, basically. And they continued throughout 1962 to be intransigent, right? Now, what's the effect of this new Kennedy policy on relations with the NATO allies? It's like, they don't like it one bit. The Germans are particularly upset by this because the German government for years had this basic policy of just refusing to legitimate the status quo, refusing to endow any international legitimacy to the East German regime. Because if you did that, then basically that's tantamount to accepting the division of your country. You view the division of Germany as totally illegitimate. There were also a set of political calculations involved on the part of Adenauer. Adenauer is very pro-Western, more pro-Western than the average German. And his feeling is that in order to integrate Germany into the West, which is absolutely essential in order to transform Germany into a truly Western country, to do that, you had to kind of discredit the alternative policy, the policy championed in the 1950s by his social democratic rivals, which was for Germany to break with the West, make a deal with the Soviets, a deal that provided for the reunification of Germany, but of a neutral Germany, a Germany that did not belong to either bloc. You know, for Adenauer, this is just a recipe for disaster. If this reunified Germany was weak, who was going to protect it? It was not going to be part of NATO anymore. It would be vulnerable to Soviet military pressure. If it was strong, then that would create problems of its own, right? The key was to integrate Germany in the West, and that meant accepting the division of Germany, because the Soviets would never agree for a unified Germany to be part of the Western Bloc, right? They're not just going to hand over East Germany on a silver platter so that it would add to the power of the West as a whole, okay? But Adenauer knows that the alternative policy, the reunification, Kuhn neutralization strategy, had a lot of appeal within Germany. The Americans also knew this, and that's why they felt that they had to really go the extra mile to support Adenauer and give him what he needed. But Adenauer said, we have to kind of discredit the socialists. And the way he did this was not by saying, we're abandoning unification, but by taking an extremely tough line on the reunification issue, a line that he knew would be totally unacceptable to the Soviets. We don't accept even the eastern border of East Germany, the Oder-Neisse line, it was called, the loss of pre-war German territories to Poland, right? We don't accept you know, the legitimacy of the East German state, or any, you know, all of these things, very, very tough line, had the important political, domestic political benefit of Adenauer outflanking his, you know, more nationalistic opponents from the right by raising all these demands that he knew were unfulfillable. So the German government had become committed to all these shibboleths about we can't do anything to endow East Germany with recognition. You know, we won't accept the legitimacy of anything the Soviets are doing, and so on. So when the Americans are moving toward a policy of de facto recognition, you know, accepting the reality of East Germany, as well as, and the Soviets for their part would accept the reality of West Berlin. The Germans were not pleased about this at all, in large part because a lot of this stuff was done unilaterally without really consulting with them and getting them on board. Right? So the Germans are progressively alienated in late 1961 and early 1962 by this American policy. And Adenauer, in fact, is, you know, leaks documents and this sort of thing. He's moving toward a revolt against America. And what makes it possible for him to do this is that Germany is not isolated in this regard. Germany has important support on the part of the French. The French, under French President Charles de Gaulle, gigantic figure in the history of this period, he doesn't like what the Americans are doing, either in the military sphere or in the political sphere. It's not that substantively he disagrees with the American goals. He wants a peace based on the status quo. He's not a believer in German unity. He likes the fact that Germany is divided and so on. But he doesn't like the way the Americans are playing the Western hand. They're giving away too much too fast, and thus they're projecting an image of weakness. Not an absurd, you know, analysis. Okay? The substance might be correct, but the tactics were totally wrong. That's one objection. The other objection is, you know, all this stuff that the Americans are doing to kind of basically emasculate Western Europe, deprive the Europeans of access to nuclear capabilities under their own control. This is inconsistent with the sort of role that Europe should play in the world. See, the French, They understand the importance of an American presence. But they also are worried about America becoming too strong within the Western alliance. Their feeling is that there has to be a European counterweight to American power within the Western alliance. America is necessary to balance the Soviets, but within the Western world, the Americans can't be allowed to be too strong. And all the stuff that the Americans were doing, you know, with the remember all those acronyms last time with the MRBMs, the MLF, the PALs, and, you know, the change in secular status, and, you know, all those things. The Americans are running away from nuclear deterrence, and yet nuclear deterrence is the only thing that can keep the Soviets at bay. So de Gaulle becomes progressively alienated from the U.S. policy in late 61, 62. Plus, he feels that what all this means is that push comes to shove, and there and the Soviets push the thing to the point where the Americans are have to going to decide about war and peace. The Americans will never do it. They'll never use nuclear weapons. In the event that West European security is threatened. They might use it if the American homeland is threatened, but that's a different story. Right? And he thinks that the Americans are going to cave, that they don't have the guts, really, to put their own cities at risk in a serious way. He says, this is 1961, he says, we are at the moment of Munich. He thinks the Americans are going to cave. And when that happens, you have to worry about what the consequences are going to be. Because if the whole NATO system collapses and the Germans lose faith in America as a protector, there has to be some alternate arrangement that you're going to put in place. What would the Germans do? If they turned to some weak form of neutralism that made them vulnerable to Soviet political penetration, that would be terrible from the standpoint of France, right? For all of Germany to be under communist control. On the other hand, the Germans became nationalistic and they got away with it and stopped building up their nuclear forces. That's also very dangerous. There's the optimal solution from the French point of view after the collapse of the NATO system that they anticipated was some sort of Franco-German bloc, some sort of West European, you know, neo-Carolingian sort of bloc that could give the Germans an alternate focus for their national energies and provide an effective counterweight to the Soviets that could replace the now defunct NATO system. That's the de Gaulle view. And so in order to create the political basis for that, he has to kind of side with the Germans in terms of opposing America's new NATO strategy under Kennedy. See, I mean, for Kennedy, he has to fight this war on two fronts. It's hard enough just dealing with the Soviets under Khrushchev, right? But now he has to also deal with the Europeans, the continental West Europeans, the West Germans and the French, basically. Very daunting thing. You know, vastly complicates this problem. In the long run, Kennedy and his top advisors think America is so strong and has such important means of leverage that the Europeans, or at least the West Germans, can be pretty much forced to do what the Americans want. If the Americans are able to strike a deal with the Soviets, the West Germans can be forced to go along. Right? That's the Kennedy view. But still a problem. Right? The core of the problem, then, has to do with U.S.-Soviet relations. Can they reach an arrangement? Kennedy has gone the extra mile in terms of his willingness to be flexible. That flexibility, however, is treated as evidence of weakness. The Soviet position remains intransigent in late 61 and through 1962. March of 62, the Americans proposed their plan, laid out in this document called the Principles Document. What's the basic idea of the American plan? Acceptance of the status quo. We'll keep West Germany non-nuclear, right? Both sides accept political realities. We accept East Germany as a political reality. You, for your part, have to accept West Berlin as a political reality. On that basis, if everyone accepts these things, we can live with each other. Basically, we're going to give you a non-nuclear West Germany, guarantee that. In exchange for that, you accept our military presence in West Berlin. essential to protect the political and economic status quo in West Berlin. We're not going to sacrifice the freedom of these 2 million West Berliners. Right? It would be humiliating for us. Our entire position in Europe and ultimately in the world as a whole would collapse if, after all these solemn commitments we've given to protect West Berlin, those commitments were revealed as utterly worthless. We're not going to do it. We're a great power. You wouldn't do it. Kennedy tells Khrushchev, we're not going to do it either. Right? That's the American plan. Soviet response, we'll take the concessions, but we're not going to give anything in return. So gradually, in the summer of 62, the Americans come to the conclusion that a showdown with the Soviets is inevitable. In fact, the Soviets say, we're not going to do anything until after the American midterm elections in November of 62. But after that, we're going to insist on a Berlin settlement along the lines that we had laid out. In other words, for you guys to have to get out of Berlin. Right? And this is unacceptable for the Americans. They sense that a showdown is a matter of time. Okay? And so what is the American reaction? American reaction now is to say, if a showdown, if a confrontation is inevitable, it's much better for us to have it sooner rather than later. Right? Why did they think that? It has to do with the way the strategic balance is changing. Remember that chart I put on the blackboard? You know, of how the strategic balance had changed and how after the buildup of the early 1950s, by the end of the Truman period, the Americans had just overwhelming strategic superiority, you know, gradually fades in the late 1950s. Americans still have an important nuclear edge in the early Kennedy period. But Kennedy is told that it's not going to last forever. It's just a matter of time. It's not going to be too long before the Soviets achieve nuclear parity and America no longer has a nuclear edge. Nuclear edge means, can you rationally go first in the event of a war with launching an all-out attack basically against the other side with the hope of neutralizing the other side's retaliatory forces so you wouldn't suffer too much with from the weapons that survived that attack, right? Americans still had that in the Kennedy period. Kennedy is told it's not going to last much longer. And in fact, in September of 1963, this is another very important date, Kennedy is told we no longer have it. We no longer can rationally launch a first strike. Right. This is the end of America's nuclear superiority. They know it's coming. They know it's not far off. If that's the case, we don't want to just kick the ball down the road in the whole Berlin problem. We don't want the Berlin crisis to break out after we've lost that extremely important instrument of power. Much better, therefore, to bring matters to a head now. See, this is this whole Windows logic that political scientists pay so much attention to. You know, this is almost like preventive war thinking. You know, we can't wait. And it's Kennedy, that's his frame of mind that he's in when he learns about the deployment of the Soviet missiles in Cuba. And the decision to make the Cuban business such an important issue, that decision it has to be understood in the context of this larger thinking. The Cuban Missile Crisis is not this isolated event that just has to do just with Cuba. Right? The stakes are very broad. They have to do with U.S.-Soviet relations in general and all the stuff that's happening in Europe with Berlin. Right, because the Cuban Missile Crisis, you realize, is also a crisis about Berlin. Because if we blockade Cuba, the natural countermove for the Soviets, if they had enjoyed nuclear parity, would have been to blockade Berlin. And so when we move ahead with Cuba, we have to anticipate that they would react in that way, and are we truly willing to escalate in the fashion that had been decided upon in 1961, in October of 1961, right? What's the importance of the Cuban Missile Crisis? Americans take a tough line. And, basically, and it's the Soviets have backed down. The Khrushchev policy is revealed as bankrupt. All his threats about, being willing to risk World War III, this is revealed as pure bluff. And as I say, he kind of pays for this with his career. He's forced out of office in 1964 by his colleagues in the Soviet leadership. Very, very important. Why? To be understood in the context of those ideas developed by people like Jeffrey Blaney and James Fearon about how a conflict increases in the perceived risk of war, the level of risk, how these sorts of things draw out information about each side's true resolve. Right? If international conflict is in large part to be understood as an information problem, where both sides disagree on how strong and how resolute each other is, well, then as a crisis sets in, it draws out important information. It clears up that information problem, right? We see that Khrushchev was engaged in a bluff. We see that the policy he had pursued was bankrupt. Second effect was vis-a-vis the Allies. This whole de Gaulle notion that we were the Hour of Munich, the Americans would never risk a serious nuclear showdown with the Soviets, turned out to be not true. The Americans were much tougher than the French had anticipated. Meaning that, maybe a political system based on long-term American military presence in Europe is more viable than de Gaulle had thought. A lot of people in the West, in Western Europe, felt like Kennedy's stand over Cuba endowed his policy with much greater credibility than it otherwise would have had. Right? Plus, there's a third effect, which has to do with Kennedy's own sense of himself and his relations with his subordinates. His subordinates had basically sold him this policy in 1961, this policy toward Europe of concentrating all the nuclear weapons in American hands, of getting the European allies out of the nuclear business, and so on. Kennedy had come to the conclusion that that policy was a big mistake. It was kind of a disaster. It had poisoned our relations with the Europeans, and it hadn't gotten us anything in terms of a deal with the Soviets. And he had come to the conclusion at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis that his own judgment was better than that of his advisors, which, by the way, in my view, was a totally valid conclusion, and that he could kind of strike off with it on his own and change the basic policy that had been adopted and put in place in 1961. And what is the change that he had in mind now? It's like, you could ease up on the whole question of British nuclear weapons, French nuclear weapons. Yeah, those countries, we could help to develop meaningful nuclear capabilities. But in exchange for that, we wanted them to side with us on the policy that we were pursuing with Russia that focused on the German question, right? The Kennedy notion is Germany is going to be deprived of a nuclear force, Germany is going to be singled out in that regard. Because what we're going to do is we're going to reconnect with Britain and especially with France and reconstitute the bloc of the three Western powers, Britain, France, the United States, isolating West Germany within the Western alliance. West Germans weren't going to like it, but they're not going to have any choice. They have nowhere else to go. Right? This is the new Kennedy policy that's put in place after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Reach out to the British. This is the meaning of this whole Skybolt affair, the Nassau Conference in December of 62, right after the missile crisis. It's new policy. It's not just the concocted to kind of deal with a minor political problem that developed. We're abandoning the policy that had been adopted in 1961. Kennedy thought the whole multilateral force was a big joke and so on. He only kept it in place because it seemed to bother the Soviets, and that meant that it was a bargaining chip that we could use with them. Not just with the British, also with the French. All these overtures to the French at the end of December of 62, or beginning of January 63, we're going to help you with your nuclear force. But it's part of a general understanding where we kind of come together and pursue the same policy on all these kind of core European issues. Okay? And the same for a while, the French were going to go along. Then what happens is that George Ball, Undersecretary of State, he was kind of the leader of this whole clique within the State Department that had gotten the president to sign on to that policy in 1961 of basically emasculating all the Europeans in nuclear terms. Ball couldn't accept the fact that Kennedy's policy had shifted. And so he goes over to Europe and he tells the Europeans, no, our policy remains intact. We still believe in the MLF. We still, are opposed to national nuclear forces and so on. And de Gaulle can't believe it. He says, on the one hand, the president has been promising this stuff, and now the Americans are saying exactly the opposite. And de Gaulle kind of explodes. This is, he gives this famous press conference on January 14th, 1963. This is where he announces that Britain is not going to be allowed in the common market. But the real policy is directed not so much against Britain as against America, because for Britain to come in, according to Gaulle, she would just be America's Trojan horse. And if you wanted a Europe with a political personality of its own, you couldn't have the British come in. It would have to be built just by the French and the Germans. And Adenauer, the German chancellor, he kind of comes over to Paris a week later. He signs this important treaty, the Élysée Treaty, between France and Germany, siding clearly with de Gaulle, and de Gaulle's rising up against America. Big crisis in the alliance in early 1963. This is not what Kennedy had wanted, right? And this is before anything had been really solved with the Soviets. So what happens is Kennedy says, well, there's not much we can do about France, but we have a lot of leverage over the Germans because of geographical realities. The Germans are much more dependent on American military protection than the French are. And by threatening to withdraw, we can get the Germans to toe the line. Big crisis in U.S.-German relations over the Élysée Treaty in early 63. We basically drew the line in the sand, said, You want to pursue this policy with de Gaulle? Go right ahead, but then just forget about American military protection. If you want American military protection, you got to do what we tell you. And the Germans kind of cave. They put a preamble into the Franco-German Treaty that basically drains it of any political meaning, reaffirming Germany's commitment to NATO and to the alliance with the United States. Adenauer is pretty much forced out. He views this as the third time in his political career in which he was fired. He had been fired by the Nazis as mayor of Cologne in 1933 and by the British occupying authorities from that same position in 1945. Now he was fired by the Americans. The Americans basically told the key leaders of Adenauer's own political party that they got to get rid of the old man. He was very bitter about it. So the NATO crisis kind of came to a head in early 63. Not in the way that Kennedy had wanted. And this lays the basis for what would happen with the Soviet Union. Right. We had demonstrated that we had the ability to call the shots in the West as a whole. Would the Soviets go along now with the sort of settlement that the Americans had laid out beginning in 1961? Our terms didn't change. The policy embodied in the principles document of March 62, that's still intact. Right? The Soviets don't want to accept an overt deal. They don't want to make it clear that after talking about West Berlin being an ulcer and a rotten tooth that had to be pulled and all this stuff for all these years, they were now willing to formally accept the status quo in Berlin. Right? But the fact that they're not willing to do it formally doesn't mean that they're unwilling to do it in a kind of more tacit, more informal way. Okay? And in fact, the vehicle within which the settlement is worked out is the negotiation of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of July of 1963. This is like the top of the iceberg. You know, it symbolizes a whole web of understandings that had been reached in the negotiating process that led up to it. Why was the Test Ban Treaty so important? Because the curse of nuclear weapons, had to be dealt with, and this was an important step in the interest of all humanity. No, it was important for political reasons. People think of arms control as an apolitical process. Why was the Test Ban Treaty important in its own terms? Because if countries can't test nuclear weapons, they can't build. The test ban doesn't prevent America and Russia from continuing to build their nuclear arsenals. It only applies to atmospheric tests anyway. What it does is prevent new nuclear powers from developing nuclear capabilities, because if they can't test, they can't build. Right? And who are the nuclear powers we're worried about? Two countries. Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, and the People's Republic of China. Right? The test ban negotiations are in part designed to explore the possibility of joint U.S.-Soviet action against the Chinese nuclear program, military action, I mean. Soviets aren't quite ready to go that far, meaning that the only country that could be affected by the test ban would be West Germany, right? But if we are giving the Soviets something they very much want, in other words, a guarantee of West Germany's nuclear status, then they got to give us something else in exchange. What is that? Berlin. And in these negotiations, the Berlin issue and the whole question of Germany's nuclear status are tightly bound up with each other. This is a deal that ties everyone to the existing status quo. Right. It's not aimed overtly against West Germany, because no one wants to discriminate against Germany in such a blatant way. Right? The test ban is framed in general terms, but it's clear who's being targeted when you look at the discussions. The importance of this arrangement is that it ties everyone to the status quo. If there's a link between West Berlin and West Germany's nuclear status, well, what that means is if the Soviets move against our presence in West Berlin, then the next thing they're going to know is that West Germany is going to be moving ahead with its own nuclear program. Right? They don't want that, so they're going to lay off Berlin. Similarly, we tell the West Germans, this is actually quite interesting, we tell the West Germans, one of the reasons you guys should stay non-nuclear, is to maintain the threat value of a threat to go nuclear in case the Soviets move against West Berlin. Right? And the Germans said, gee, you know, never thought of it that way. You can't threaten that you'll go nuclear if you're already a nuclear power. But the threat can be used politically only as long as you stay non-nuclear. Very nice kind of argument. But it shows you how these different elements have fallen into place in kind of have come to kind of comprise a system that doesn't end the Cold War 100%, but it kind of ends at like 90%. Cold War remains, but it loses its apocalyptic edge. People are no longer worried about the prospect of a third nuclear war. Okay, so let me end there. Next time, I'll bring the terms of the essay question, and also I'll be talking about the post-1963 period.